I'm going to present a work which is in collaboration with Arno Kailas and recently appeared in the Journal of Nonlinearity. So this is an extra reference besides the list and the one I gave in the list of abstracts. Okay, just give a short overview of what I'm going to do. In a minute I will introduce some orthogonal polynomials, which are orthogonal on the real line, with respect to a weight which is parameterized with a parameter t, and t is positive. And these orthogonal polynomials are particularly interesting for this workshop because they generate solutions for the discrete Dannecke-Watt equation. And next I will derive some asymptotics for these polynomials and its features. And then on formal grounds you can expect that there are some critical point that t is minus 1/12. However, since the polynomials are only defined for positive t, some care should be taken here. And so this is only on formal grounds. So to overcome this problem, I will introduce some other polynomials, which are now orthogonal on contours in a complex plane. And I will show that these, again, are related to the discrete Dannecke-Watt equation. And we will derive asymptotics for these polynomials. And at the critical point, we will find that these asymptotics are described by Dannecke-Watt equations. And I will give a short hint of the proof, a short hint of how the Dannecke-Watt functions come in. So, I start with the orthogonal polynomials. I start with a function vt. It's x squared over 2 plus t times x to the power 4 over 4. And then I define for t positive Pn as the monic orthogonal monic polynomial of degree n, satisfying this this orthogonality relation. Well, orthogonal polynomials on the real line, they all satisfy a three-term recurrence relation, which means that Pn plus 1 can be expressed in its two previous polynomials, and it's x times Pn and some An times Pn minus 1. And this coefficient An is called recurrence coefficient. And in this special case, for the quadratic potential, as we say, you find that the recurrence coefficient itself, they satisfy the nonlinear difference equation, which is stated here, which is a discrete Dannecke-Watt equation, which appeared a couple of times before in this workshop. So, in this way, we generate solutions for the discrete Dannecke-Watt equation. Now, if you want to do, we want to find asymptotics for these polynomials and these recurrence coefficients, and one of the important tools in the study of asymptotic analysis of orthogonal polynomials is the so-called equilibrium measure. This measure is defined as a minimizer of an energy functional, which is stated here, among all Borel measures on the real line with unit mass. You can view this as putting many, many particles on the real line, and the particles, they have the total charge is 1, and they repel each other. So if there was no potential here, they would just go to infinity, but they are also influenced by the potential which keeps them together. So there's repulsion in the logarithmic term, but there's also a potential which keeps them together. Well, in the case of our quadratic potential, this measure can explicitly calculate it, and there's a mistake here. Well, you see there are two variables, ct and dt. You see there's a square root over ct squared minus x squared, this is of course wrong, and some quadratic term. And I will keep this on the slide for a while because I need this more. So in particular, see actually that this measure for t positive is defined as this equilibrium measure. For negative t, the measure is actually also defined, right? But you should be, if t is bigger than minus 1/12, the measure is still well defined. But it's not a minimizer in this sense.
You don't keep the n in front of the v.
Well, I will take later. I will take n equal to the big n equal to small n.
Yeah, but in your functional, you don't put in.
No. Otherwise, yeah. Sometimes you put the ratio in, but I don't put the ratio in because I will mainly discuss asymptotics with big n equal to small n. Now, if you using this equilibrium measure and some techniques in orthogonal polynomials, and you set small n to big n, and you let n to infinity, you find that the recurrence coefficient is given by this limit for n to goes to infinity. It's a function of t, of course, and it's given by 2 over 1 plus the square root of 1 plus 12t. So if you look at this limiting value, you expect indeed a critical value at t is minus 1/12. However, the polynomials are not well defined. But on the other hand, the discrete band of A equation is well defined for t negative as well. And the limiting value is well defined. And the measure is well defined, as long as we are take values for t bigger than minus 1/12. And also this minus 1/12 is known in physics literature that if you do a double scaling around this point minus 1/12, the discrete band of A equation goes over in the continuous band of A1 equation. But however, we started with a solution of the discrete band of A equation, which was only a solution for positive t. So we have to overcome this problem so that we also have solutions for negative t. Now, this case was for the first time rigorously analyzed by Fokas and Tsikitaev, and we will follow their proof for a small while. But their idea was to define the orthogonal polynomials for t, for negative t as well, but then the orthogonality should take place in the complex plane, not on the real line anymore. And then they formulated a Riemann-Hilbert problem, which characterizes this orthogonal polynomials. And then the third step is that they formulated the Lux pair for this Riemann-Hilbert problem, and then they did a WKB analysis of this Lux pair and this Riemann-Hilbert problem, and proved actually that t is minus 1/12 is indeed described by band of A1 asymptotics. But later, this is a 1992 paper which Fokas talked about this morning. But later, in 1999, there were a lot of people, Dive, Kirchenbauer, McLaughlin, Finakides, and so, and they developed a method to analyze this type of Riemann-Hilbert problems in a direct way. And they developed a method to analyze the asymptotics of this Riemann-Hilbert problem if you consider polynomials which are orthogonal on the real line. And this is a very powerful method and has a major impact in the asymptotic analysis of orthogonal polynomials. And our goal is now to apply this method in this case where the orthogonality is not on the real line but on the contours in the complex plane, and obtain now pan of A1 asymptotics directly by applying this method. So it has some certain benefits. We do not use the Lux pair, and we do not explicitly use the discrete pan of A1 equation. So it's a direct proof starting from the Riemann-Hilbert problem. And the third one is that this admits a generalization. And to understand this third benefit, just take a look at the measure here. If you take at t is minus 1/12, you see that ct and dt are actually the same. They coincide. And you see that this function goes into this, takes this form. And you see that there's a power 3 over 2 vanishing at the endpoints, square plus or minus square root over 8. And we believe that that you will always find pan of A1 asymptotics if you have a power 3 over 2 vanishing of this equilibrium measure. So it admits a generalization. For Kasitsa Kitaev did it for general potential. We only take the quadratic potential for simplicity, but it will work for all these cases. Okay, now to define the orthogonality in a complex plane, what do we do? We define certain contours, gamma 1 to gamma 4, which I have shown here. This is gamma 1, this is gamma 2, gamma 3, gamma 4. I give them an orientation and I give them a weight. And instead of integrating over the real line, I now define a bilinear form by integrating over these contours and multiplied by the weight. Note that that all the integrands here are analytic. So I started with these contours, but I could also, by analyticity, deform the contours. So what I can do and what I will do later on is to not consider this contour, but deform the contour in this way, such that gamma 1 and gamma 4 are for a short time on the real axis. So they coincide here. And the same for gamma 3 and gamma 4. But then at a certain point, they leave the real line and go to the complex plane go to infinity in the right sector. So now you have five contours, so you have a gamma 0 as well, And the weight of gamma zero is, so now in this bilinear form you should also integrate over gamma zero, the weight of gamma zero is 1. This is, so if I take the special case alpha equals beta, then this is a special case because then we have symmetry in our problem. This was a situation which was already discovered by Foucault and Skitaj. So we take a slightly more general bilinear form by allowing a non-symmetric case as well. Well, now the polynomials are now defined as the monic orthogonal polynomial of degree n. I should have added here degree n, that is orthogonal to all polynomials of less degree less than n. Now, note that I defined a bilinear form which was not an inner product. So we don't have Gram-Schmidt, which tells us on the real line that you have that these polynomials, that this definition of the polynomials is correct, is that they are well defined, that they exist, and that they are unique. So we don't have this in this case. I will not go into too much details about it. But what we do know, which follows from the analysis of Foucault-Tsitsikitaev, or our analysis, that you know that for if n is large, that the polynomials pn plus 1, comma n, bn, comma n, bn minus 1, comma n, that they exist, that they again satisfy a recurrence, so that the pn plus 1 can be expressed in its previous, the two previous polynomials. But now we don't only have a n comma n, but we also have a b n comma n. But this is because of the fact we take a non-symmetric bilinear form. So if you take the special case alpha equals beta, where you have symmetry, then you see that that bn comma n is actually zero, and alpha n a n comma n satisfies the discrete Banach one equation. Now to state the result, to give the result of Banach one asymptotics, I first will introduce the solutions of the Banach one equation which we are particularly interested in, and to that I start with the Riemann-Hilbert problem for the Banach one equation. You define a Riemann-Hilbert problem for a function psi, which is a 2x2 matrix valued function, which is analytic in a complex plane, except for a few rays. And on this rays, it makes jumps. And the jump matrices are given here. Note that there are a lot of equivalent versions of the Riemann-Hilbert problem for the Banach one equation. We took one which is slightly a modification of the one that's considered by Kapayev. And we also take a special case. We only have one parameter here, so we take a special choice for the other parameters. So this is a special case. It does not generate all the solutions, only special solutions. Now, except for the jumps and analyticity, I also need to define asymptotics in these sectors. And I impose that psi has the following asymptotics. So you see that there's a dependence on x in the exponent here. Well, if I do that and write the first order terms as well and give them a name, psi 1 and psi 2, and then I find the function y, which depends on alpha, and x depends on alpha because psi depends on alpha in the jump here, and x because it depends on x in the asymptotics, that this is the 1, 2, and 3 in the second order term times 2 times I. Well, then it's known that this function y alpha is the solution of the Banach one equation. Well, it's not just a solution. We know Kapayev characterized, actually also to give a nice proof using Riemann-Hilbert techniques of the asymptotics of these special solutions. And all y alpha, they have a common asymptotic series for x goes to minus infinity. This is a common asymptotic series. And if we take y1, so we take alpha equals 1, then this asymptotic series is actually valid in a wider sector, which uniquely characterizes it. And then you find that the other y alpha, they only differ by y1 by exponentially small terms if x goes to minus infinity. And these exponentially small terms are linear in alpha. Okay, so now this characterizes the function y alpha, the solution. So
Y1 is exactly the same solution of the Boutros solution.
Sorry,
that Y1 is exactly the same solution of the Boutros solution.
Yeah, I think. Yeah. So now let us state the result. So there's a critical point that t is minus 1/12. So instead of, but we will not take t equal to minus 1/12. No, we will let t depend on n and vary around minus 1/12. We take a double scaling limit. So when n goes to infinity, we let t depend on n such that the x defined by this relation remains fixed. So as n goes to infinity, t goes to minus 1/12. And note that we take both x positive and negative, or 0, you can take all values, as long as x is not a pole of y alpha or y beta. Then we have the following result. Then we find that the first recurrence coefficient is given by this asymptotics, and the second coefficient is given by this asymptotics. Note that, again, if alpha equals beta, we are in the symmetric case again, and bn is just 0, drops out. But also the non-symmetric case is described by the one functions. So let me give a slight hint of the proof. The proof, we start in the same way as Foucault-Tsitsikhitaev did. We pose the Riemann-Hilbert problem, which is due to Foucault-Tsitsikhitaev. So we consider y is an analytic function in the complex plane, except for, and I have to take, I think that is something. So, gamma is this contour or the deformed version of it. And it's analytic. So, y is analytic in the complex plane except for this curve. On this contour, it makes the following jump, where alpha z is the weight of the local weight of the contour. And y has this asymptotics. So if you consider this Riemann-Hilbert problem, then the solution of this Riemann-Hilbert problem is described in terms of the orthogonal polynomials. So in the first column, you see the polynomial of degree n and the orthogonal polynomial of degree n minus 1. In the second column, you see its Cauchy transforms. But moreover, we can also express the recurrence coefficient in terms of the solution of y. How do you do it? Well, if you write some extra terms in the asymptotic expansion, you define y1 and y2 as the first two terms.
The 2-1 element is a tn minus 1 n z?
Oh, that's it. Sorry. Yes. Yeah. Then you can define an, n in terms of the first correction term and bn, n in terms of the first two order terms. So now the procedure is as follows. If we can find asymptotics for y, we can find, we've immediately obtain asymptotics for the polynomials and the recurrence coefficients. So that's what we are going to do, to find asymptotics for y. Let me put this Riemann-Hilbert problem on a slide. Let me put it here. If you're on the case t bigger than 0, then you're back in the polynomials on the real line again. In the case, then you have then this Riemann-Hilbert problem is also valid, but then you have to take gamma equals to the real line, and the weights here are all just one. So you have a similar, you have exactly the same Riemann-Hilbert problem. And in this case, there was the Dive-Tsao steepest descent method was applied by these five authors. It was a very important work, and I want to describe first how this works for the case t is positive. So we are now back in the case for orthogonal polynomials on a real line. Well, the first two steps in this method are actually two transformations. You go from y to t to s, and these transformations are simple and invertible. What I mean by that is, if you, they are just easy transforms, just some simple in nature. And if you find, the idea is if you find asymptotics for s, you can easily invert these transformations and find asymptotics for y. So instead of asymptotic, so we will try to find asymptotics for s. And a second property of this transformation is that they are all based on the equilibrium measure mu t. Oh, it's sorry, come on. And Of course, we have to keep in mind that this measure mu t was also defined for negative t, although it was not an equilibrium measure, it was defined. So we can try to use the same transformations, because we know that the equilibrium measure can just be extended. Well, for the case t bigger than zero, how does S look like? Well, S is again a 2x2 matrix valued function, and it satisfies the following Riemann-Hilbert problem. So it's analytic in C, except for a contour, and the contour is given here. So here you see the real line, which comes, the real line, plus two extra curves, which we call the lens. This is the upper lips of the lens, and the lower lips of the lens. And on these contours, it has a jump, which has a constant jump for on this small interval, which is exactly the support of the equilibrium measure. It's a constant jump. And on the other jumps, in other contours, it has jumps which you find some exponentially terms with a function phi t, which is related to the function to the measure mu t. So phi t can be expressed in mu t. And you find that S is equal to the identity plus order 1 over z terms. Now, if you look what happens with this function phi t, if you plot the real value of phi t, then in the shaded area there the real part of phi t is bigger than zero. So you see that the jump here is actually exponentially converging to the identity. In the white area, in the white regions, you see that the real part of phi t is less than zero. So again, you see that the jumps here are exponentially converging eventually fast to the identity. So what you expect if n goes to infinity is that these jumps just drop out, and you only have one jump left on this interval as a constant jump. So you can hope that your function S converges to m, where m is the solution of this Riemann-Hilbert problem. And this Riemann-Hilbert problem you can calculate very easy. However, this is not true near the endpoints. We were a bit too naive in our thoughts, because of course point-wise these jumps converge to the identity. However, if you are close to the endpoints, you don't find uniform convergence, and because of that you don't find uniform convergence, S will not be close to M near these endpoints. So near the endpoints you need to make special solutions, which are done by array functions in the case T is positive. Now, let us see what happens if we try the same method, but now for the case T is between minus 1/12 and 0. Then here you find again that S is described by this Riemann-Hilbert problem, where you find again the contour, the deformed contour over which we integrate, plus a lens. Again, on this interval, the jump is constant, and we find jumps on the rest of the contours, which are again expressed in the function phi t. And if I now draw the areas where phi t is as a real part bigger than zero, you see that there's a shaded area here appearing, which covers the part of the real line. But I can still deform my contour as much as I want. So if I deform my contour such that it remains in these white areas, I again find that all the jumps converge pointwise to the identity, except for this jump, which is this constant. So if I do that, I find exactly the same behavior of S as in the case T is bigger than zero. So again, you don't find uniform convergence, but you have to make special solutions around the endpoints by means of array functions, and you're exactly in the same case. So that can be completely dealt with with usual techniques. However, in the critical case, you are in the T is minus 1/12, you see that the real parts, that the shaded areas, the forbidden areas where the contour shouldn't come, actually meet at the endpoints. So now I cannot deform my contour just a piece on a real line and then go to infinity and see that the local behavior here is exactly the same as in the case T positive. Now I have that the local behavior here is completely different. And it's the reason why is that at minus 1/12 the measure vanishes at the endpoints with a power 3 over 2 instead of 1 over 2. So now I have to make special solutions around these endpoints. This is exactly what the Panhoff-Hill 1, the Riemann-Hilbert problem for the Panhoff-Hill 1 equation comes in. So this special solution around the endpoints is constructed out of the psi functions which I introduced before. Okay, I want to give a final remark that, of course, if t is fixed, we use indeed the measure mu t, but if we are considered the double scaling limit in the critical case, it's not very wise to use the measure mu t. It's actually better to use a different measure, a measure we call nu t, which is again an equilibrium measure, but now it doesn't minimize among all positive measures, but the measures may be signed, we have more freedom in the measures, but we impose that all the measures have fixed support, minus the square root of 8. And this idea, to use this in the double, only in the double scaling limit, was first introduced by Kleis, Kuylaars and Valesse, and Blekkers and Kuylaars, and this is a very powerful new mechanism in the steepest descent analysis. Well, let me see if t is just in the critical case, or I take t is equal to minus 1/12, then this measure nu t is again the measure is equal to the measure mu t, so nu minus 1/12 is equal to mu minus 1/12. But if I go a bit above minus 1/12, I see that the measure indeed gets a minus sign here near the endpoints, goes to infinity, goes to minus infinity at the endpoints. And at the other side, if I take t left for minus 1/12, I see it goes to infinity, to plus infinity at the endpoints. Now, the local behavior is actually now influenced by this new measure. So we get different pictures for Vt, where the real part of Vt is bigger than zero. However, because this only takes this, the measure only behaves different in a very, very close to the endpoints, and near the endpoints we were to make a special solution anyway, we are safe. But there are some subtleties which are involved here. Okay, that was what I wanted to talk about.